the word for it now. Back in the old days, when a lot of selling took place on QST's one days in the back of the magazine, you would see, if you studied three consecutive issues, and if you were interested in a Kenwood TS711A, that's what you're listening to right now, a 2-meter all-mode rig. Tip of size covers 144 to 148, sideband AM, sideband FM, and Morse code. That's all mode, and got some nice characteristics. It's a middle 1985 rig, is when it first came out. Nowadays, the equivalent of that rig is $1,500. I know if you shop around a little bit, you can buy that $1,500 valued rig in modern-day equivalent, and this one does 90% of what the modern-day equivalent will do. You can buy it for around $300, $250, in that neighborhood. So by nowadays, by looking at eBay, if you go to the Ham Radio 1S in eBay and study them for a couple of days, you will find out what the going rate of something is. That's the easiest way. Or talk to your friends. So, the best way to buy a used piece of equipment, let me drop, is to first find out what was 10, 15, or 20 years old that people love. You try to buy a used TS711A, it's fairly difficult, because the guys who put their hands on one will not let it go. It's got a built-in 110-volt power supply. You can feed it 110 volts. You can feed it 12 volts. It's not a super compact box. You're not going to use it as a mobile. It's a desktop box with a handle on the side, very portable if you want to take it to your field day site. It's got a knob on the front panel where it's completely variable in power output from 1 watt up to 30 watts. It's only got 30 memories. But it does a lot of good things. It's an extremely good synthesizer. So, if you buy one of these used, so the problem of buying it from eBay is a newbie is going to worry himself sick about, am I buying a lemon? That particular rig, it's extremely difficult to buy a lemon. If the rig you buy, when it gets delivered to your house, has a dented front panel, and you think the world has ended, that may not matter. You bring it to a guy like Andy, WHFCDL, who can fix anything. And because you bought a rig that's not an empty box, 98% of all the parts to make that thing work are there. The worst that'll happen is if the thing was in a lightning storm, the front end transistor, which is a $2 part, might need replacement. In my case, I did have a failure on the three of them that I own. One of them wants the diode in the power supply disconnected from the board every time it heated up. A little bit hard to find. But we soldered a diode down and the problem went away. 98% of all the parts required to make that rig fly are there. So it's almost impossible to buy a lemon. So you've got to choose a rig that's been around for a while, that's got a track record. You've got to choose one that's 10, 15, 20 years old. You've got to find out from eBay or your friends what is the going rate for a thing like that. And you don't have to get top dollar, because a brand new equivalent is going to cost you $1,500. Because you found out that a friend of yours 6 months ago bought one for $255, and the one being advertised right now is buy it now at $285.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The one being sold right now, buy it now, is $285. You know a guy who bought it at $255. $285 is a damn good price. The fact that somebody got it $30 cheaper, you got to subtract that from your memory. That's nickel and dime stuff. What is it worth to you? Do you have the resources to buy it? Is it the right price for that rig today? The fact that somebody once got it a few dollars cheaper, and you try to nickel and dime the owner and try to get it down to that particular price, there's an 80% chance you're not going to be the buyer. So you don't want to do one of those deals. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people and talked them into going to a stockyard that's got them free of charge. 3/4-inch hardline, as many features as they want on the end of the reel. You know, they buy it in 5,000-foot reels, and when there's 150-foot left on the end of the reel, they send it back to the stockyard because they don't want to take another run down the street where they're going to put a splice because the splice is unreliable. So you go to a stockyard, you can get lots of hundreds of feet of that stuff. It's worth $5 a foot, and you can get it for free. A buddy of mine once went to a stockyard in lower New York State and the guy wanted to charge him a nuisance fee of $10 to pick up hundreds of feet of that cable. He knew somebody in some other town that got some of that cable for free, and he refused to pay the $10. Bad choice. I told him, you go back to that man, hat in hand, hand him $15, and say, I misunderstood, I'm ready to pick up that cable. At $5 a foot, and he was being offered hundreds of feet of it, and he turned it down because it was $10, because a friend of his got it for free. Craziness. So, with a little bit of homework, you can find out what rig is the one you should own by talking to your friends and looking what's popular in those days for the guys who want to save money. And by eBay and QST ads and talking to your friends, you'll find out the ballpark. I say the ballpark is $300. If you get one for $285, fantastic. If you have to pay $325, you haven't been taken over the cold. It's a darn good rig and a darn good price. That's sort of my philosophy. Not a complete answer, but it works for me. I bought lots of rigs used over the years. I bought almost nothing new. Of the last 20 pieces of equipment I bought in the last 20 years, one of them was brand new. Of those 20 pieces of equipment...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
On those 20 pieces of equipment, I did get stung on one of them. An extremely unusual case where a particular ICOM rig... That whole production run, they forgot to remove the rosin from the slow solder machine when they made the printed circuit boards. And it was a very active rosin that was slowly eating its way into every one of the integrated circuits and into every one of the variable capacitors of the synthesizer. And that rig became very unreliable on 15 stages at once on four different printed circuit boards. That was a real lemon. That's a rare case. A whole production run of ICOM of a particular 2-meter, or it was a 440. It was a 440 megacycle all-mode rig, which had this rosin left on all the boards. It took a while to figure out what's going on. The boards looked kind of homely. They hadn't been cleaned. This very active rosin was eating into everything. And the problem took about 4 years to happen. And 4 years downrange, one stage at a time, everything failed. That's a rare case. So, don't look for perfect cosmetics. If there's a slight dent and a scratch here and there, that doesn't stop the quality of the signal that comes out of the rig. You got to be reasonable. K2KEY, KQLIW. How do you buy used equipment, Mel? I bet you a lot of the stuff you bought is used.
Roger, this is... Yeah, I've got quite a bit of used equipment, but have these, of course, the facilities and hopefully the knowledge to fix them. But for the average ham, young ham, you got to be extremely careful. Unless, of course, you do feel that you can maybe, you know, trust the person you're buying it from. Over eBay and places like that, I've seen some real horrors, misinterpretation of exactly what was going on, and or if it was intentionally done, I don't know. But they got themselves really a problem child. And it was nothing like, you know, I could say the basic description of the picture. So, if you can go to a ham fest and if you're going to buy the rig, and the price, again, now about the price, you don't go by what the price of the original, because that's what they'll tell you about. My oldest rig was $2,000, and I should be getting back at least now, you know, $1,000, but it's 30 years old or whatever. It doesn't make much sense. You're going to plan to keep that rig a number of years. If the price is approaching within a small percentage of what the original price is, it doesn't make much sense if that rig has got change on it. Let me let it drop, and I'll say one more thing. If you're planning to keep the rig a number of years, I find that many times buy a little cheaper radio, and if it's new, but doesn't have all the bells and whistles, a lot of things that you can do without, I think you'd be better off than purchasing some of the secondhand equipment. Again, unless you can, you know, see it work, or know the person or whatever, or if you go to a ham fest like Limart has, and Andy is there, and he'll check it out for you, that's a complete different situation. But I notice a lot of stuff that shows up on the eBay and things like that, they won't take it to a ham fest for some reason, take over.
Well, one nice thing that eBay has is that each seller has a track record that you can check into. There's a rating system. How many times has that particular seller on eBay sold things? What percentage of the people bought something from him wrote a report saying they were pleased with the purchase? There's a hell of a lot of vendors on eBay that have got a 5- and 10-year track record where they've sold 50 things and 49 of those people are happy. So most of the eBay sellers have a track record. So there is a rating system that helps. Again, by talking to your friends, you can find out what are the important questions to ask. Does it come with a owner's manual? The fact that it comes with a brand new box doesn't cut any ice with me. It's nice, but that's not a buy or a sell decision. I'd like to get the owner's manual, and if I can get a service manual, that makes me very happy. Does the owner know that it was operating the last time it was used in operating condition? If not, that makes the price a bit lower. If the person selling it is not the person who previously owned it, and if he says as is, where is, and he doesn't know if it's operating, yes, you got to be careful. I've bought 10 or 12 things on eBay. I haven't been stung once. Maybe I'm lucky. Maybe I asked the right question. Maybe I bought simple things. I'm not quite sure what all's going on. But to be at a Limon flea market and get the permission of the seller to pick it up off his bench, walk it over to Andy's test bench where Andy connects it to his instrumentation and says, yes, it's putting out 30 watts. Yes, it's got the right modulation. This is an operating rig. That puts you way ahead of the game. So there are ways you can self-protect. Over to you, Mel.
Hey, I think still goes. A lot of these things that are on eBay show up as a one-shot. And, you know,
I hear you, Joe.
Whether or not they're going to get a bad feedback, they just want to get rid of this one piece of equipment and grab whatever they can. So it's ticklish. It's a very ticklish situation. A few times I've outed people over to a reasonably priced rig, brand new, against a somewhat more pricier radio that's a few years old, saying, listen, for what you want to do, it's going to suffice. And you'll be better off getting that spanking new radio right out of the box. Again, with the eBay, it's, for me, it's very iffy. And if you're not in the position to be able to handle a complicated repair job, you're going to find that if you have to take it to a service place, somebody to service it, that they're going to really make it possibly that you didn't get any bargain at all. You know, these places that service ham equipment, they really charge. If you go back to the manufacturer, they're outrageous. But even a lot of these so-called, you know, people that are in the business of repairing this stuff also get phenomenal amounts of money over.
That's the point. Joe's got something to add to this, and I suddenly realized we forgot to go to Paul. Joe first, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. A couple of years ago, I bought something relatively cheap, but I had a bad problem with one of the sellers on there. The guy sold me a programming cable for a radio that was no good. And the thing that I looked at was this guy had, he sold a lot of stuff over the past couple of years, but he had a tremendously bad track record. In like, you know, 6 month segments, he'd have like 6, 7, 8 negative feedbacks per a 6 month segment on his record there. He had like, compared to his percentage of stuff he sold, it was rather low. It was like 98, 99%, something like that. But he had like, you know, a couple of good, you know, marks on him every 6 months. And I always thought eBay supported the type of thing or the type of action where if he had more than 2 or 3 negative feedback things within 6 months, that could suspend your selling privileges. They really don't seem to support that very much anymore. Because I asked about that, and they says, it doesn't matter as much anymore. That was the answer I got back. That these guys sell a lot of stuff, but they get a very, very small percentage. They don't go by that as much as they used to anymore. So you have to really be careful with what you buy on there. And the other thing I could say that you can really, to really protect yourself is, I bought things always through PayPal and always back it up on a credit card. And if the guy on the money is going to screw me, I'll go right back to the credit card company and do a charge back on the charge. I don't even go through eBay. I don't even go through PayPal. I tried doing that once, and they were just giving me a bunch of, a lot of runaround. So that's a good way to protect yourself, especially if you're spending a couple $100 out of your pocket.
So if I understand you correctly, Joe, I think you're saying that since you paid PayPal with a credit card and you denied the charge with the credit card, that reflected all the way back, and that person eventually didn't get paid. Is that what you're saying, Joe?
Whether that guy got paid or not, well, in this particular case, with the bad program, it was like $29. It was like $29 or $30 with shipping for the cable. First of all, with their money back thing, the first $25 you don't get back. So that's kind of stupid with the whole policy, the way that works. So you should work it out as a percentage, not a flat fee. You buy something that costs $3,000, you lose the first $25, big deal. But if you buy something for $32 and you don't get $25 back, it's a different story. So I don't really like the way PayPal has a policy set up. That's why I went back to the credit card company. I got all my money back from the guy.
Interesting. Another comment I was going to make along these lines. Yeah, I think what PayPal is doing, what eBay is doing, is that if a person has a bad track record, you can read that and you know about it. You know what risk you're taking. Buyer beware. And if the thing he's selling is such an extremely good price, and you want it bad enough, and you're willing to gamble for a guy who has sold 10 things and 5 of the people who bought it from him are unhappy, that's your choice to make. So eBay doesn't deny him the ability to sell things, because in theory, the guy may have seen the error of his ways, and he's not doing that anymore, and eBay is giving him another chance. The fact that his half track record is there means it's obvious to everyone involved. So there's no hidden information. I can see the philosophy of eBay continuing to allow the guy to sell things. He maybe is correcting the problem. And maybe he's going to continue to be a bad guy. You can read his track record and you know about it. You know what risk you're taking ahead of time. There was another person who signed in with a very weak signal. Try again.
This is KC2TSS.
I'm just barely hearing KC2TSS. I think you're on the other input. I'm going to start listening to you on the input. Go ahead.
Okay, the thing is that the only time the state will get involved is when they see that it was advertised differently than it is. If you know that it's brand new and fully functional, and it's all not working, they will take action. They advertise falsely, and false advertisement, and they will take action. But otherwise, they won't. If they say,
Danny, and I'm hearing him on the input very noisily on the Eastern End machine. And what he's saying is that the way EB operates is that if the material you're selling is different than what you advertise, then eBay will take action. If you advertise the object as being brand new and it's used and dented, then you're fibbing in the way you advertise it, and eBay will take action. But other than that, if what you're selling is as advertised, and even though you have a bad track record, they will allow you to continue to sell it. So I think Danny is essentially saying. Okay, Paul, W2S2N, sorry I keep you waiting. I know you got to get up in the morning, and if he's already left us, I'll understand. W2S2N with the space report, KQRIW.
No, I'm still here, Dick. No, I'm retired. I can hang out, no problem. Yeah, Dick, I don't have much of a space report, but I did want to bring up in January's issue of QST. They had a good story. They called the De-Expedition to Planet Mars, page 59. So, you know, a lot of people skip through a lot of pages on QST. But if you have any kind of interest in what young people have in the back of their minds and in the future of, you know, where they're going, this is a very good article by this Andrea Bottledge from KG4IUM wrote the article. Good article dealing with this habitat that they have out in Utah, 26 foot diameter habitat. Different groups go out there and live in this facility for a couple of weeks at a time. This has been going on since 2002. I've seen a show on this some years back, a documentary dealing with this place. And what they do is they actually live in there, and when they leave, they put spacesuits on, and they duplicate the conditions, what it would be like to live on Mars, like I said, a couple of weeks at a time. But the whole place is set up like that. And this person wound up with the ability, what happened was she won an award years ago through CQ magazine, and one thing led to another. She won an award to go to a space camp, and as time went on, she got a little older and wound up with this group. And good article there. They spend 2 weeks in this place, make believe they're on Mars. If you go to the place in Utah, it basically looks like.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
No, I didn't see that article, Paul. And you did time out there for a little while. I'm still skeptical. I'll admit that a hell of a lot of our youth in high school is dreaming about a belief that their generation will see an astronaut standing on the surface of Mars. I personally believe that will not happen for a whole bunch of reasons. We're going to send lots of robots there. The January 2009 issue of Scientific American has a very nice article about the Mars Global Laboratory, is that what it's called? Mars Science Laboratory. The Mars Science Laboratory, and it's overrun and it's delayed. Nice picture, and it's a very big vehicle. Boy, that's a lot of pounds of stuff they're going to be sending there. And those actuators are giving them quite a bit of grief, so it's going to be delayed 2 years, I think you told us. I did last week, and I didn't read far enough in the article to confirm that. But lots of good stuff is going on in space. I used to be a strong advocate of manned space travel. I'm now slowly becoming an advocate of unmanned space vehicles. You get an awful lot for your money with very little risk. And many of the places, many of the places where we sent remotely piloted vehicles to Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and pretty soon Pluto, and beyond Pluto with the Voyagers, and Mercury and Venus, we sent vehicles to essentially every planet in the solar system. The vast majority of those places, there is absolutely no way you can get a man there, have him survive, send him there for a reasonable length of time, and bring him back. Or is you getting lots of megabytes of data out of those spacecraft, those telescopes, and so on. So you get more for your money. There are people who are somewhat critical of the International Space Station. Are we getting enough to justify it? Well, we don't have the choice to make anymore because it's there, we've got to use it. Is there enough benefit to send people back to the moon? It's an interesting question that will be discussed a lot in the coming years. Let me ask you a quick question on that one, Paul. When it comes to man returning to the moon, in the articles that you've read and the NASA reports you've read, have you seen enough justification? I mean, the Apollo program was a little bit over $30 billion in 1970s money. That means in the year 2015, 2020, it's going to be $100 billion, $150 billion. Is there enough justification to authorize that kind of a price tag. WS2N, K2RIW.
And you, with a comment.
Alex recognized, but I'll call first. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah. Well, Dick, I think the you've got $30 billion for the complete manned program from Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. When I think of the top that has just been released, what is it, $700 billion for the banks, military budgets that are astronomical. Percentage-wise, I think it was something like 2% of the GDP that for the $30 billion when the manned program was first announced to, I think it's something like 1/6 of that now that they're spending on the entire NASA space program, manned and unmanned. And it's a 60-40% relationship, 60% for whatever the money's coming in, 60% goes to manned, 40% for unmanned projects. Can they up that number? Sure, they can up that number. In this kind of a economic environment, highly unlikely, especially now with Michael Griffin. He, it looks like they have a little friction between them and the new administration coming in. Some problems there. Will there be a new administrator in the future? I would say yes. You're going to see that probably in a couple of months. Unfortunately, I like Griffin. He's a ham. But I think things are going to change. Are they going to completely change the Orion, what do they call it, the Constellation program? Let me drop it. What they have planned now with the Orion capsule system. Four people to the moon, one shot. Land on the moon, leave the mothership in orbit with nobody on board for a couple of weeks at a time, and come back. And then maybe 5, 10, probably you got like a 5-year span as it is between the end of the space shuttle and the Orion system. Maybe another 10, 15 years after that, at the earliest, before you could have a Mars shot using basically the same spacecraft system. Probably highly unlikely unless a lot of money is poured into the system. Will it be done in the future, our lifetime? I don't know, Dick. But an article like this takes into that, you know, into the consideration that sooner or later it will be done. I guarantee you. I don't know if we're going to live for it, maybe my grandkids. Somebody's going to look through this and they'll see eventually people landing on Mars. You cannot have an unmanned space program without a manned space program, because people want to see people flying in space. That's where the money's coming from. That's why you get the 60-40% relationship, because you have a manned space program. You know, the spinoff of that is all these unmanned space program. And like you, you probably got, you know, I know we've got more scientific data probably from the unmanned spacecraft than we have from the manned spacecraft. But will it happen? Yes, I can't put my finger on it of when that will happen. But maybe if you're with the 80, 90 years old or something, you might have a shot back here.
Yeah, thank you for all that information. And I did forget about the fact that the $30 billion was not just Apollo. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. And the side effects we get out of that, the fallout, a hell of a lot of computing and strength of materials and whatever. And we put a lot of people to work for a lot of time. That money wasn't just wasted. It was our people being paid salaries to build that hardware to do that work. And now, hopefully, the new administration is going to put a lot of people to work building green energy objects, renewable. I'd like to see a lot of the people that are out of work now, put to work with the modern day equivalent of work projects agencies, the WPA that the FDR put into effect to get us out of the last Great Big Depression of 1929. People were building bridges and dams and roads, and they were put to work. And now they should be building wind generators and solar panels and tide generators and so on. Let's see what Alex has to say about all this. N2MNU, the voice of Yonkers, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
All right, I like that, the voice of Yonkers. It's my voice only, and it reflects my opinions. I guess this country will be much better served if we spend all this money that we spent on the financial markets, $700 billion, GM, I don't know how many billion dollars or whatnot, putting a man on the moon or on the Mars, all of that is inconsequential. If we spend that much money, we should have put it in anti-gravity. If we can resolve this problem, we will not need anything else. Hey, with this, good night, and when you're going to sleep.
Makes very good science fiction, Alex. But can anti-gravity really be done? That's a toughie. Also, I'm not against the money that we're doing with the TRP or whatever it's called, the recovery program, the $700 billion, because in theory, that's affecting an extremely large number of people that are either out of work or about to be out of work. We're essentially defending our whole damn economy. And although that's extremely expensive, I don't think you've got a hell of a lot of choice. And I know there are people that will differ on that one. But, I know that the space shuttle is being disconnected too soon before the replacement is available. And so I suspect that the space shuttle is going to be extended, even though we think it's about to be cut off. Mel, I think it's time you read your next mail. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I agree, Dick. W-S-2-N. Bye-bye.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, right now we've got a lot of so-called terrestrial problems, and Dick, you gave a very good answer to what if we had the power to be. What I would also suggest that projects like FDR did institute some projects. Of course, they later on struck down a lot of his ideas and projects and all that. The Constitution does not permit this or whatever, but, he said, listen, right now, we've got to do something, put a bandage on this bleeding this country is going through. We've got to stop the bleeding. And I think we've got the same situation right now. And things today, well, okay, we can build bridges again. The bridges that they built during the 30s now have to be replaced. The roads that they were built have to be repaired or rebuilt. And we could add on now, like you say, alternate energies of developing different energies and get our reliance off this foreign oil. I think it's a great idea, Dick. You should put that right to the president, over.
You and I are doing the best we can. We're talking to hopefully a major group of people in a tri-state area. I'd like to believe that some percentage of these people will lean on the administration if they haven't already decided to do so. We've got to become independent. I don't care if it's going to take 2 years, 20 years, or 200 years. The longest journey begins with the first step. You've got to start somewhere. And to have 60% of our energy coming from an unstable place in the world, and we pay top dollar to people who don't like us to get that material, that's got to change. We're losing a hell of a lot of American blood in various places trying to create the stability to make sure that we have an oil flow. We wouldn't have to be doing that if we were energy independent. We wouldn't be spilling American blood and American dollars. We have the resources. We have the technology to build the hardware, to use the resources we've got to be energy independent. And for a nickel and diming reasons, we haven't done it. It's time we catch on. We gotta smell the coffee. K2KEY, K2RIW.
N2RDB with a comment.
Mr. RDB, start off with your name.
Your name here is Tim. That's Tango India Mike. I'm in West Hempstead.
Go ahead with your opinion there, Tim.
Yes, I do agree with you. We have to become energy independent, and so far the large corporations and their government cronies that they put into office have been stymieing every attempt at doing that. We have all this oil coming from Alaska, every drop of which gets sold to Japan. We have offshore oil in Northern California. Well, can't drill there because it'll bum out the surfers. Can't drill in the Gulf of Mexico because, you know, God forbid the green people should get upset, even though the Venezuelans and the Chinese are drilling everywhere offshore of our nation. And, you know, we're letting the corporations dictate national policy here. And I agree, we have to lean on the administration. Because if you get 10 or 20 million people, you know, leaning on their elected officials saying, why isn't something being done about this, then there might be some action. But as long as everyone goes home and parks it in front of the TV every night and lets the TV tell them how to think, then nothing's going to get done and things are only going to get worse. You know, but we do have to become energy independent. And the power companies don't want us to have windmills and solar power. You know, they want to have something they can regulate. I mean, the wind and the sun are free.
They sure are. And the fact that oil went from close to $140-some-odd a barrel down to $30-some-odd a barrel, what in the world is going on there? We didn't cut back our consumption by 3-to-1. There's obviously some kind of middleman there boosting the price who decided to bail out. There's craziness there that's got to be corrected. So, hey, Tim, sounds to me like the people in Mineola know what's going on. By the way, your town has got a very fine hospital. I guess you know about that, right, Tim?
Yes, yes. My home QTH is actually in West Hempstead, but my P.O. box is in Mineola, yes. I work in Mineola, too. Yes, it's a most excellent hospital. We just have to lean on our elected officials, and how do we do that? By writing letters and circulating petitions and peaceful, lawful demonstrations. I'm not advocating illegal activity here, but I mean within the legal framework, you know, we can let our officials know what we feel needs to be done.
And what you're really talking about here, Ed, I mean, Tim, is education. We're talking about changing public opinion and eventually changing the opinions of our elected officials. All of that is really education. In my opinion, an educated man will say the fact that 60% of our energy is coming from unstable foreign locations is intolerable. An educated man will say, how in the world have we allowed that to happen, step by step over the last 40 years? Once we see the error of our ways, once we see a much better way, once we educate enough people about the better way, it's got to happen. That's an opinion. Those guys in Dover Street, they know how to swing opinion. K-Q-K-E-Y, K-Q-R-I-W.
Very good, yeah.
Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, this is a point in that you'll probably find the Obama is stretching out the shuttle program for a little while longer. But the reality is that of the federal budget, 0.58% of the federal budget goes to NASA. Okay, during the Apollo program, it was 1.1 or 1.2% of the federal budget. So their budget is only $17 billion at this point. Considering all the work that we've gotten out of NASA, the things that people don't think about, goes along with aircraft safety and so many things, and everything that you look at, with the new guy's emphasis on technology and using it to
improve life, what better organization do we have in place now that's connected with all the universities and everything else than NASA? So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Although, I forget his name, the guy who's the head of NASA at the moment, got a little defensive about the Obama folks wanting to take a look at his program, Orion program. So I guess we'll have to see what happens on the 20th, because I suspect a lot of things are going to go on very bad. But it comes down to, for every buck we spend on NASA, they spend $100 on social programs. And that doesn't include military or anything else. So figure. It's RWP, Drew.
Let me ask you this question, Eric. When it comes to a very important issue to me, and probably fairly important to you, energy independence, I don't care if it's tide, geothermal, wind, solar, North American gyre, which is better called the Gulf Stream, turbines in the Gulf Stream, drilling for oil, all of these techniques to some degree are relatively high technology as far as the American general public is concerned. To a person who really knows a lot about it, it's not rocket science, but still it's relatively high technology. One organization that has dealt with about the highest of technology in a lot of areas simultaneously is NASA. Is NASA the right organization to have a sub-branch that leads us into energy independence? If we double the budget of NASA, tell them to increase their staff, hire the right people, and have one division that's devoted to space and another division that's devoted to energy independence, are they possibly the right people to do it? They certainly have a lot of connections and a lot of organizations, a lot of institutions, a lot of universities. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
It is sounding no NASA from Antoine.
Okay, Alex thinks so. Let's see what Eric thinks.
No, I kind of disagree with that, because, they've changed over the years. I mean, you need to put management in there that's going to utilize their facilities and the brain power that they have and redirect it, and direct it in a way that, well, let's say they kept the current budget and added to that budget. There you have the organizational capability of doing things that would really benefit. I personally am involved in some energy stuff, as you know, and I really do think that kind of R&D that they provide is totally worthwhile. It wouldn't be a waste. But then again, I mean, look at Bell Labs. Look at what happened to Bell Labs. Look at what came out of Bell Labs. Bell Labs isn't called Bell Labs anymore. It's, what's it called now? Let's see. RCA Labs became Sarnoff, and Bell Labs became Lucent, actually. Lucent Labs. Lucent, they have another name for it. But when Bell Labs and Sarnoff were in their heyday, you had an idea. It didn't matter if we were going to make any money or not. You go explore it, okay? Today, that doesn't happen. You have to have an idea that's going to show that you get a return on your dollar before you even begin. And that's why a lot of the technologies that we see now, some of the stuff that has come out of Bell Labs, which is just about everything that we touch, transistors, ICs, that kind of thing, and Sarnoff, the amount of stuff that comes out of there is very slow and very military-oriented or very commercial-oriented, and you don't have the big, big turnovers of technology that we used to see every 3 to 5 years. Now you're relying on universities, on private manufacturing, and they don't do anything unless they see money in it. So, NASA being not a commercially gold organization, to me, is still a good choice.
Okay. If the public, for whatever reason, decided that NASA's plate is already full, and they're unwilling, as Alex just expressed, unwilling to fund NASA to make another division for energy independence, who should do it? that it's not NASA, who? We can create a brand new figurehead, the energy czar, but where in the world is he going to go to connect, to collect the cabinet of smart people to support him? One man can't do that. It's going to take a large organization to really make us energy independent, because you've got to attack four or five technology fronts simultaneously. Solar, wind, tide, geothermal, whatever. You've got to attack them, and nuclear. You've got to attack a whole lot of reasonably high technology fronts in a much better way simultaneously. It's going to take a big organization to do that. By the way, Bell Labs, let me give a couple words on that one. Let me drop.
WBQIKK.
IKK recognized. Or is it ITK? Anyhow, Bell Labs, the good news is they had lots of excess money by which they could launch into beautiful research and development projects that didn't necessarily have to prove their return on investment before going there, before they were allowed to make breakthroughs. That's the good news. The bad news is, but Bell Labs and ITT and ATT were a kind of monopoly. There were people who thought were being raked over the coals a little bit with our phone prices. There wasn't competition. It was a monopoly. They removed the monopoly. Our phone prices, in theory, got a little bit cheaper. We got competition, multiple phone companies. But now that organization doesn't have the cash flow to do that R&D. So we gained something, we lost something. Mr. ITK, I think it is. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jess. This is George, WB2IKT. Just a couple quick comments. We already have an energy czar. There already is a U.S. Department of Energy. They're primarily involved in nuclear work, and they work with the national laboratories. They're doing quite a bit of work with located national labs right here on Long Island, working on fuel cells and, believe it or not, oil burner research, which I think you know something about, probably quite a bit. Anyway, that would be the U.S. Department of Energy. And for the record, Bell Labs has split into a number of organizations. Part of it is owned by AT&T. They call themselves Shannon Labs, after Claude Shannon, who invented cybernetics and the theory of communication. It's now called Telecordia, which is a consulting firm which primarily does consulting for communication
companies. How about that? Okay, so the energy czar that we've got, should he be given a hell of a lot more cash flow? Should he be allowed to expand his organization, expand his manpower, such that we can do all of those five energy source fronts simultaneously instead of in a serial manner, and attempt to do it in 5 or 10 years instead of 100 years? Should we do that, George?
Great question. I believe the answer is yes. I believe the funding should go, they should set up a department, the organization of the Department of Energy, similar to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. And, of course, the Internet came out of that, and a whole load of useful technology. And, yes, the Department of Energy should have such a program going. Right now, they're primarily focused on nuclear stuff, and as a result, because of their focus on nuclear energy, a lot of the stuff they do is secret because, you know, it's a very small step from developing enough heat to build a generator to developing the same amount of heat in an extremely short period of time and making things become full. So their focus is very secret, you know, probably because they do a lot of stuff we don't know about. So, yeah, I think they should expand. Is it exactly the right agency? I don't know. I mean, they probably ought to sequester the nuclear part of it off and put more emphasis on developing alternative energy sources.
Hey, Drew,
go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, first of all, Bell Labs is part of Alcatel.
What about Bell Labs?
It's the organization that got split off, and a lot of broadcast technology, believe it or not, came out of it. And then Alcatel, a French company, came and scuttled them up, so they have nothing and had nothing to do with AT&T for a long time. That's one thing. Secondly, there is something called the NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory. They're based in Denver, just outside of Denver, Colorado.
They have a big lab on the Big Island of Hawaii where they do geothermal research. They actually do a lot of really good stuff, but they are so underfunded, it's pathetic. And the third most important thing is that we don't turn out engineers and chemists and scientists anymore. We do turn out a lot of computer people, but we don't turn out physicists, chemists, and engineers at the rate that we did at one time. So even if we did start a new organization to try and focus on this, there ain't nobody to fill those positions. That's another reason why NASA is a good place to start, because there is a center of talent that exists there. The Energy Department, as George said, is really totally focused on nuclear power. Even in NASA, there is a group of nuclear physicists which provided the technology for the Stirling engines and the Galileo and the deep space probes that have the nuclear power supplies in them. So that's not alien to them either. Let's see, NASA also is one of the foremost places of knowledgeable people on fuel cells. Actually, a lot of the NASA people are working at Brookhaven Lab. There's a big NASA office there where there's a lot of connections. So, you know, it already exists. It's in place. A lot of the labs are shut down. They're mothballed because they haven't been manned because of lack of funding. But if they put some funding back into it, and we're not talking much, if they brought them up to 1%, it would be amazing.
And then you... Alex recognized. I like the sound of that, Eric. However, I'm a little bit worried on such a big project of complete energy independence is what we're really talking about here. And there's five technology fronts, approximately. Geothermal, wind, solar voltaic, tide, Gulf Stream. All of these technologies, there's four or five fronts simultaneously. I'm afraid of putting too many eggs in one basket. Let's divide that up. Let's divide it up between NASA, Department of Energy, NREL. In other words, make a decision that NASA's going to take the photovoltaics. That's certainly a major area in their mind because the photovoltaic cells power an awful lot of their satellites. Maybe when it comes to thermal conversion by nuclear source into electric energy. They also, your Galileo and the spacecraft that are at Mars and Jupiter, Jupiter and Saturn, are powered by nuclear power cells because there's nowhere near enough solar light out there. So NASA's obviously got the technology there. So let's put some of the money in each of two or three different baskets. Let's see what Alex has got to say. And N2NNU, K2LIW.
Ah, it's about 12 o'clock. Last word. I think before we're jumping into the idea of creating something new and beautiful, we should take care of improving what we have. It will cost us much less. Do you realize that more than 50% of our energy, I'm speaking about electrical energy, is lost in the transmission lines? Why don't we try to improve that? To lower the losses that we have now. If we lower the losses by 10% only, we're going to get a net gain of about $200 billion per month per city. This is something that you can't sneeze at. So rather than going off the wall and inventing windmills that might not work every day, Don Quixote, let's improve what we have. Second point is that the days of centralized power generating are long gone. We need now a system that will allow every household to create its own power. And this is not done by windmills. That has to be some basic research in physics and whatnot, finding new ways of creating power out of, atom smashing or whatever. But that can be created on a commercial basis. I don't know if you know. Let me drop it.
We're going to have
this guy in California that has created a 2-meter by 2-meter cement block with two poles coming out of it. And this produces its own generator that can generate power for 10,000 homes. Try what happens when it, guess what happened when he wanted to commercialize it. So, ideas are there, we can do it. It's political issues that we have to encounter and try to bypass them or surpass them or whatever. So those are the two issues. First, improve the network, the transmission lines and everything else. Second of all, let the private sector be innovative and do whatever it can do. NASA is not meant to do that. Private sector has to do it.
I don't agree. Okay, we're going to have to stop because we're about to be cut off. This was TechNet number 1219 of the series. We almost solved the world's energy problem, but we ran out of time. It's every three you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, say a couple of closing words. 12 a.m.